Oops. So, good afternoon. We have a quorum, so we'll get started with the MTC Policy Advisory Council meeting for Wednesday, November 12th. Our first order of business is approval of the October 8th meeting minutes. I'll take a motion from Rich. Second? Second from Will. All in favor?
Aye.
Abstained? Two abstentions. All right. And then public comment on items not on the agenda. I have one public speaker card for Ken Bukowski.
Hello. My name is Ken Bukowski, and I record these meetings. And I have updated a webpage, regional-video.com. And if you go to that website, you will see the latest meetings right up front. And then I have a separate index for all the meetings, so I think you'll find it easy to access. You know, if anybody wants to do a video recording, like if you have an issue and you want me to record it, I'll be happy to do that for free. So just let me know, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bukowski. All right, so we'll then move on to subcommittee reports, and I'll turn to Randy Kinman since Naomi is out ill today.
Thank you. We had the shortest meeting on record for the Equity and Access Committee, which gave us time for lunch and chit-chat. We received a report on the Technical Advisory Committee to the Regional Means-Based Transit Fare Pricing Study program that's going to be going into effect. The bid is out for consultants. They hope to have one on board, and the process started at the beginning of 2015. It'll take anywhere from around 9 months to complete, and we'll be getting periodic updates. If you look in the Equity and Access packet, you'll see the Technical Advisory Committee members, and I have to say that I'm really pleased with the diversity in the membership on that, and I think we're going to get some really good results out of it.
Thank you. So we'll then move on to agenda item number 5, the MTC 2015 Draft Advocacy Program.
Good afternoon, everybody. Rebecca Long, MTC staff. So the first main item in your agenda is our draft advocacy program. And we note on the in the cover memo that we did bring, we did have a discussion here about general advocacy ideas. You know, some I think you'll see reflected in the program, others maybe not so much. But I'm just going to walk you through it. Thanks for giving it a half an hour on the agenda so we don't have to rush too much. So the first item, of course, is transportation funding. It's always a our main focus area, and basically we're going to be looking to secure new sources of statewide transportation funding. There have been some ideas talked about by some of the main advocacy groups like Transportation California, such as looking at returning truck weight fees to the state highway account, potentially doing a revenue bond that would allow new projects to be funded without costing the general fund, so some kind of package with, you know, new revenue sources, but also allow some bonding. So I think those conversations are ongoing, and MTC will definitely try to be at the table for that and support new ideas. I think the key message is we don't think cap and trade funding has fully solved our transportation funding needs, so we're going to have to keep at it. Another item that came to our attention when we had a meeting of our partnership legislative committee, which is made up of you know, all the different legislative staff from transit agencies and congestion management agencies, is Sonoma County Transportation Authority is interested in pursuing an increase in the cap for the local sales tax portion, as was obtained by Alameda County and Contra Costa County, allowing for Measure BB to be enacted by the voters. So we want to support Sonoma County, and I think there was some interest among other counties as well in the Bay Area to allow for additional sales tax for transportation to be put on the ballot. Third, item 1C on the state budget. You know, this is just more of a placeholder, but acknowledging that, you know, the budget is a place where policy can happen, and to the extent that we can use our transportation funds more effectively in the state budget, we'll be looking for opportunities there. And then last but not least, we did include Regional Measure 3 on here. That is basically going to be seeking authority for MTC to put on the ballot again at some point in the future. We're not saying when, as of yet, an additional toll increase. So this would just be the first step in what would undoubtedly be a long process, you know, thinking about what the timing would be, what types of projects would be funded. But of course, there is a requirement that any projects funded with a toll increase would have to have a nexus to the bridge corridors. Should I stop there, Randy, or do you want me to just keep on, Kathleen, keep plowing through? It's up to you guys.
Carolyn, did you have a question at this time?
Not at this time, but I may.
Okay.
When she gets
to Otherwise, we can keep
Thank
moving.
You.
Thank you. Oh, Rich, did you? Go ahead.
Okay. The next item, sort of as far as a subject area, is Senate Bill 375, implementation. So how do we implement our sustainable community strategy? And the first piece there is on increasing state funding for affordable housing. As you all know, the cap and trade legislation this past year does provide quite a bit of funding for affordable housing that will be increased over time as those revenues grow, but it's certainly not adequate. Again, you know, just as transportation needs more funding, so does affordable housing. And we have heard that the speaker, who, you know, is definitely a big housing advocate, does intend to continue to seek a statewide dedicated funding source for affordable housing. So we want to engage in that and support that effort. Next, on bicycle and pedestrian safety, that's something that was definitely talked about at your meeting, and we want to support legislation that increases safety. You know, we did support a lot of bills related to that this past session. Unfortunately, I think there were three that were vetoed because the strategy there was all on increasing the fine. And Governor Brown clearly is not a proponent of increasing penalties as a way to achieve policy outcomes. So, you know, we'll see what comes up. But I think, unfortunately, that approach doesn't seem to be the right one with this administration. And then lastly, just an item related to the cap and trade funding that has been approved. There's still a lot of devils in the details as far as the regulations that the state agencies that were assigned responsibility for these new funding programs were given. And so we want to engage in that process of working on the guidelines, commenting on them. And then there's also some cleanup that's needed for the transit capital program, the competitive program. Bus operators are not explicitly made eligible, even though bus projects are, so that's something we want to clean up. And then also making the disadvantaged community requirements for the formula program a little bit more practical. Okay, our next item is a familiar one on bridge toll evasion and specifically requiring temporary license plates at the point of sale on new and used vehicles. I'm getting a little tired of talking about this because it's been, 5 years? But we are encouraged. We have had high-level conversations with the Brown administration that they really do seem to be supportive of finding a fix to this problem and getting temporary license plates on vehicles. So we're just starting to have, you know, more in-depth conversations with folks at DMV and Cal-STA on that. And so stay tuned. But we do plan to sponsor a bill on that again. And then the next item is on express lanes. And this is more of a kind of placeholder. We don't plan to introduce a bill on express lanes, but there was a bill introduced at the end of the last session on this that would have allowed the CTC to once again approve new express lane projects. We're certainly, you know, supportive of that idea, but we just want to make sure that any express lane legislation be supportive of our existing plans, that it not undermine in any way the Bay Area's express lane vision. So that's it on the state side, and maybe that would be a good time to pause before I go on to the federal program.
I see a question from Alan.
Basically, I've done a draft report on the extraction tax. It's 20 pages, my God. it can get longer. I don't want it to. Can I give it to you folks for your comments?
Please do.
And then what I'd like to do is when we get it back, I'd like permission to distribute it to the members of the Advisory Council and get their comments on this. It has some research in it. I've kept it short. It has some surprises in it as far as what's there. And how we should do the tax, there's some ideas in here and how it should be put together. And it also has a pretty broad range of participants in the results. We've included I have included education in the results and some of the other people who are pushing for these things, and of course housing and transportation. So I'm going to move forward. I'd like to give you a copy.
Okay, that would be great. I very much look forward to reading it, and we'll give it a close review and comment. And
beat it up. And it's footnoted, so it has where to find the backup information.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay,
Alan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Randy?
On the bridge toll evasion, while you're talking with everybody, who would be a likely flag bearer legislatively for this besides us?
Well, Assemblymember Mullen carried the bill last year. Remember, we did have a bill, AB 2197, that got through the Assembly Transportation Committee on a 10-1 vote. It just died in the Appropriations Committee. So I think he has the right of first refusal, and I think he has expressed an interest in carrying the bill again.
Okay, thank you.
In regards to cap and trade funds benefiting Plan Bay Area, with the cleanup legislation around bus operators, is there a specific champion taking that forward as well?
Yes, there is. It's the California Transit Association.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Vita?
In our last meeting, we discussed a statewide requirement for low-income communities, and I'm relying on my memory here, and we were interested in having new requirements drawn up so more of the funding would come to the Bay Area. Is there any movement on that or anything that you can report?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the state's designation of the disadvantaged communities. And the California Environmental Protection Agency, Cal-EPA, did release the final designation of those census tracts. It was an improvement over the original proposal, which had been the top 20% scoring on this methodology known as the CalEnviro screen. In their revision, they went with the top 25%. Again, I think you probably remember that we had a lot of other recommended changes to that methodology that went a lot further than just broadening the scope. But it is a substantial improvement, and we have done quite a bit of analysis that I can, share, and we can get out to all of you that shows the new map. But based on my recollection, we're going from about 46 census tracts in the Bay Area that are considered disadvantaged to about 87. So, it is a substantial improvement. On the other hand, cities such as San Francisco that only had one census tract that qualified as disadvantaged now have three. So, there's still a substantial number of communities that I think under any common sense definition would be considered disadvantaged that aren't reflected in the state's map. So we do have a bullet on this on page 2 under the ensure cap and trade funds are invested in a manner that helps implement Plan Bay Area, just to say, monitor any legislation that might come up about this. It may not become a legislative issue because it was delegated to the administration to define these census tracts, but given, I think, a lot of discontent, we might see a bill, and we'll be engaged in that.
That's wonderful. I'm wondering if you have anything online, such as a map that we could refer to or you could send to us so we could see which 87 communities are impacted.
Absolutely. We'd be happy to. We haven't posted it on our website yet, but we do intend to. But in the meantime, we can send it to the full council.
I also want to let you know that under Pam's staff liaison report, there is a brief summary on what Rebecca just talked about, and there are a few links that you can review.
Okay, should I move on to federal? Okay.
Yes, please.
So on the federal side, there isn't a whole lot of change from what we had in our advocacy program last year, simply because, you know, not a whole lot got done in Washington. But the basic strategy is to continue to seek reauthorization of MAP 21 in a form that really builds on the existing legislation. We're not looking for huge changes. The big policy change would be item 1B, where we are supporting the creation of a national freight program. That goods movement is something that has been talked about more on a planning level, but there hasn't been any funds put behind it. And so we do support establishment of a new dedicated funding source for freight. And a couple of bills have been introduced on that. So that's been interesting to see, and we're going to see what happens in, you know, the next Congress on whether that moves and gets incorporated into a longer bill. The other items are kind of, you know, straightforward, seeking to maximize federal appropriations, continuing to seek funding for our New Starts projects, and then this Marketplace Fairness Act is to broaden the the sales tax to include e-commerce, and that's something that, because so much of our funding is dependent on sales tax, it would really have a big benefit to Bay Area transportation. And then the last item, the pre-tax transportation benefits, is to restore the parity between the allowance for transit and van pooling and parking, which right now is about half of the allowance for transit is about half of what's allowed for parking. So That's it. Happy to take any questions.
I have a couple of questions, but I'll hold them. Rich Edges?
Yeah, the e-commerce bill. Jackie Speer had a co-sponsored bill with a Republican from Walmart, Bentonville, Arkansas. And we thought that was going to pass. What happened to it? I actually testified in one of the hearings.
Wow, okay. Yeah, the Senate actually passed a bill. I don't remember the bill number offhand, but the Senate did pass a Marketplace Fairness Act, but it got stalled in the House. So, you know, I think it's something that...
That's where it originated, was the House.
Yeah, I don't think it passed... That particular bill didn't pass the House.
In regard... Oh, sorry, Benna.
Thank you. Under the federal program, is phase two of the BART extension to Silicon Valley on your list of top potential New Starts priorities?
Yeah, it's not, you know, listed explicitly, but that's really what's intended, where it says the seek New Starts commitments for the next generation of transit consistent with Plan Bay Area. So, you know, all of the rail extensions that are assumed in Plan Bay Area, we will be supporting.
Hey, thank you. I'd love to see it called out if possible.
I have a follow-up to that.
Sure.
And just a follow-up question, because my understanding is VTA is going to be applying for the New Starts on their own, but does that mean that we're going to be helping to push funding from a regional point of view?
Alex Bachelman, Deputy Executive Director for Policy. I'll just jump in, and Rebecca can
Thanks.
Add to it. Consistent with sort of her last response, Plan Bay Area did identify two new starts projects, one of them being the BART extension phase two to San Jose, and the other one being the downtown extension project for Caltrain. So yes, we would be advocating for new starts for those two projects consistent with Plan Bay Area. So in the next draft, I think it's reasonable that we could call that out specifically.
Linda, and then Carlos.
To add to that, Measure BB passed in Livermore, BART extension is in there, and by God, it's going to happen in my lifetime. So we might as well support it.
Thank you. Carlos.
I apologize. I just came in, and I hope my question isn't totally out of left field, but just curious, on the federal level, just a quick overview or a pulse from staff on, now that we've had a change in the Congress, like, are there things that we're expecting that might have been happening that are not going to happen, maybe because of the change in the shift in power?
That's a great question. You know, I think that in some ways we might see more movement on, you know, reauthorization or, you know, funding for transportation, that, you know, you no longer have a, you know, bitter partisan situation, right? Both houses are under the control of the same party. And I think that one thing that I have been encouraged by is that we did not see kind of a transportation fiscal cliff that I think many of us really feared when we, you know, started pushing up against the MAP 21 deadline. So, you know, I'd say before, you know, November 4th, we didn't expect to see, you know, a very long-term bill or, you know, significant increase in funding. Now we don't either, but we might see something on the corporate tax reform side that is something that, you know, the leadership on the Republican side has said they really want to see, and that the president has also indicated he would like to use corporate tax reform as a way to shore up the Highway Trust Fund. So maybe that's an opportunity.
In regards to federal, with the pre-tax transportation fringe benefits, is there any likelihood of movement on that in the current session, in this lame duck session?
That's something our lobbyist is working on very diligently. It's a big priority, and it is something that they hope to incorporate into the various tax extenders. So, you know, we'll see if it elevates to the level of priority that it makes it in that package, but we're pushing very hard on that.
Well, thank you. I do. I'm glad that there's traction around some dedicated funds for affordable housing. Is there any discussion, as some of the new vehicles for, like, transportation infrastructure financing districts, kind of new vehicles moving forward, is MTC taking a position on any affordable housing requirements embedded in those? Are there any discussions about affordable housing requirements in those finance mechanisms?
I haven't heard any conversations about those specifically. I mean, my understanding is that the new infrastructure financing districts, I think they're called enhanced infrastructure financing districts, there might be some requirements in the legislation. I'd have to refresh my memory, but, you know, those are going to be applied on a case-by-case basis, and we now have, you know, a new law on that. If there are specific additional requirements that cities or, you know, housing advocates at the local level want to weigh in on, I don't think we would get involved in that. But if it becomes a legislative issue again, then we would. But I haven't heard discussion of that.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions or comments on this item? Will?
Is the definition of affordable housing include new and rehab units?
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
All right, Carolyn?
Yeah, I just have a quick question. Going back to the state piece, and you mentioned under transportation funding B that Sonoma County was interested in raising the cap on local sales tax, et cetera. How exactly would that work? In conjunction with the state?
So the state imposes a 2% cap on the portion of local sales taxes that cities or transit districts or whomever can put on the ballot. There's a certain amount that's allowed. And so what's occurred in the past, such as with Alameda and Contra Costa, is you have a bill that basically says, you know, in the case of Alameda, it was for a certain amount of time. So, you know, until, say, 2018, Alameda may, you know, propose to the voters a sales tax that increases by such and such an amount, notwithstanding this other prohibition on having a rate above 2%. So it would just provide that opportunity.
And did they, just to follow up, did they give any indication when they wanted that to happen?
Well, they want to pursue legislation in 2015. They didn't indicate when they want to put another measure on the ballot.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Chris?
Just to follow up on that, is that done on a county-by-county basis?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Rebecca, and we'll receive an update on that shortly. And I'm sure Alan will follow up with you in terms of extraction research.
Great. He's doing
Sounds
it,
good.
So to speak.
All right. So we'll then move on to agenda item 6, an update on Bay Area Bike Share Program. So welcome, Ursula and Sean Coe.
Good afternoon. Yeah, it's just me, Sean Coe, and the planning section, but I would like to introduce Kevin Mulder, who's new to the planning section, and he'll be helping us to implement bike share and an expansion as we proceed. I'd also like to introduce Patrick Wenzinger, who's from the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, the current administrator of the bike share program.
Welcome.
So, this is just an update on the program for your information as we to keep you informed of our plans moving forward. So I'm going to give a little bit of an overview of kind of what bike share is and what we've been doing and where it's going. So the bike share system that we have now is known as the third generation system. It's been tried before. It was tried in Amsterdam in 1965 with basically giving a lot of free bikes out, and those didn't end up well. They ended up in canals and sort of disappeared pretty quickly. It was tried again in 1995 with a little bit more technology on them, more like a luggage cart at an airport. You have a deposit, and then you could use the bike, but the deposit was too inexpensive, and that didn't work out well, despite really nice, happy faces on the bikes. So the system that we're sort of using, known as the third generation, was launched in Paris in 2007, which is now about 30,000 bikes. So it's using smart technology, so the bikes are pretty heavy-duty, built to outdoor furniture, streets, and they're docked to a docked system that takes credit card payment and communications. So this is a schematic of the bike we have now. They're really heavy, robust, 42 pounds. They have an integrated rack. They have built-in lights, which are powered by a generator hub on the bikes, and they're fully enclosed. They're proprietary parts, so that it makes it difficult to be stolen and to be disassembled. The branding that you see there we don't have any advertising on the system, which I'll get into later. But there are some advertising opportunities in the that back. They call that on the rear wheel, which is called the skirt guard. There's some advertising space, and then the bike itself, the color, the seafoam green, there's advertising space on that, as well as that front basket as well. So the way the system works is the bikes are docked into docks, which are placed on the street, either in the public right-of-way, and either by a big wide sidewalk, or sometimes parking removal, a lot of times in transit locations as well. They're docked to this station, which involves a kiosk, which allows you to use your membership fob, or you can do direct payment. And that's all off the grid. So this system is powered by solar panels and cellular communications, which allows them to be fairly easily put down on the street. And there's a lot of power management that goes into it in the software. Despite its very sort of user-friendly looks, it's pretty sophisticated on the back end. So to date, the system that we have now, which is in 5 cities, MTC and the Air District have put in about $11.8 million. This is from Plan Bay Area's Climate Initiatives Program, as one of the innovative climate programs, which was a competitive program, and bike share in the different cities won that. So we put in $7.2 million in CMAQ, $2.8 million from the Air District, TFCA, and then $1.4 million from the local agency match. So as I mentioned, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District manages the current pilot program, which is under contract with Alta Bike Share. Going forward, MTC will expand and conduct a new procurement with what could be the existing operator or could be different equipment, a different operator altogether. So this is a map showing where the systems are in place. The blue is showing the footprint of the service area. So San Francisco, which is the biggest use of the system, it's getting about 90% of all the trips, all the way down to San Jose, Mountain View, Palo Alto, and Redwood City. And we're planning expansion into the East Bay, into Berkeley, Oakland, San Mateo, and then outside of the existing geographic area in San Francisco and San Jose as well. So there's 700 bikes in total spread among the five cities. To date, which is about the time of your packet mailing, was nearly 40,000 total members that have used the system, and almost, we're probably up to that now, about 380,000 trips altogether. So that's since August of last year, so just over a year's worth of usage. So quite popular and getting a lot of trips on the system. So the way it works is there's the operations of the program, which a lot of the operations costs deal with the rebalancing. So unique to among our transportation systems, at least the sort of ride-based systems, are the ability to take one-way trips. So one of the most popular stations is the Caltrain station in San Francisco at 4th and Townsend. You can take a one-way trip over to the Embarcadero station, leave the bike there, but in order to have a balance of the number of bikes in the system, we pay our contractor to move some of those bikes back because you're going to need them back near the Caltrain station. So that rebalancing is a cost for the system, as well as maintenance, just maintenance issues with the bikes. And then there's a call center that is there to answer questions you might have. The software deals with the operations of the system, so that's the electronics that unlock, lock the bikes, take the credit card payment, take your membership information, and then the back-end web services that the customer can see. And then the hardware involves the bikes, the docks, communications, the stations themselves. We're in the middle of the system planning, which is expansion for new geographic areas. So that involves where they're going, in what areas, as well as working with the local agencies to do the permitting to put the stations down. And part of all this is marketing. We're going to be doing ongoing marketing and then a loan program, which I'll talk about. Sales, sponsorship, advertising are a big part of the revenue for systems around the U.S. With the sales, with the sponsorship and advertising, New York at least reports that they have been able to basically get all their costs back from the sponsorship and user fees. So kind of unique among our transportation systems that some have almost full cost recovery just from fees and advertising. So we've done some preliminary survey work on the bike share system, who's using it. It's a lot of young males, ages 25 to 44, so about 77% male, not many female. It is, of those people that are using it, a lot have access to personal vehicles, so while they're replacing some personal vehicle trips, they're not necessarily car-free households. So we are in the process of working on a strategic plan for the system, so that's opportunity to give jurisdictions that are interested, how much it's going to cost, what they're responsible for, what are MTC's roles, where is it going to go. And then in the spring, we'll be going out with a new request for proposals for operations, hardware, software, and we'll be taking over that from the existing five cities bike share program, as well as expanding that as well. And then we're working on a low-income pilot program, which is working with SF, MTA, the Air District, to pilot a low-income program that will be probably rolled out in the spring with the community-based organizations. One of the things about the bike share program is it for members, you need a credit card hold because you're essentially renting a piece of, you know, expensive hardware. So we're working with a community-based organization for barriers around that. And some other regions have addressed that pretty successfully. Related to that is marketing and outreach of the current system, not only to sort of the existing young white males, but you know, other communities, other demographics that we haven't reached. So a little bit about the low-income program. Boston has a really successful low-income program that's been up and running. They have a $5 membership, which is they're comparable to us in that we charge an $88 membership per year. They've had over 1,500 members sign up to date. And they have a staff person, which you can physically go in and sign up, as opposed to the way that you sign up for the system online. So you get around that barrier. And of the people that are using that, it's really, really high system usage. And they've had zero lost or stolen bikes. So basically the city underwrites the cost of replacing that bike, but they haven't had to because they've been highly successful in not losing any of those bikes. So in terms of future funding for expansion, in April, MTC Program and Allocations Committee allocated additional CMAQ money, and then we successfully applied for and received active transportation funding from the state. Details of that are in your memo in the packet. As I mentioned, a lot of the operations and maintenance costs are recouped from farebox recovery from user fees, and right now we're near 80%, which is really good for the system, and then we'll be looking at a sponsorship / advertising program for the system in the future. And in terms of expansion, there's a map up here. I won't get into detail too much. It's also in your packet. It's showing activity centers and potential locations for East Bay expansion, which would be, as you can imagine, in the downtown areas in Oakland, sort of going up through Emeryville, Berkeley, tying in the downtowns of those cities along sort of a spine, roughly Telegraph, Shattuck to Broadway to downtown. So we're still looking into the exact locations, and a lot of outreach and will have to be done with those communities from the cities. But this is kind of a rough idea of where we think it could go. So with that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
So initially we get a list going here. I see Benna, Sandy, Rich, Mike, Carlos, Vita, Jerry, Mark.
Okay. Try to keep it short, long list. Thank you so much for the presentation. Can you share any lessons learned about the suburban versus urban applications of bike share? What were some of the things that made it very successful in San Francisco, and any other thoughts that you might have?
Well, the short answer is that we're still learning, because a year is, you know, while a year is good data to have, it's still pretty young in the system. But you know, bike share has been implemented in more cities that are like San Francisco than there are, you know, Mountain View. One of the things that Redwood City has done is re-examine the location of some of their stations. So they've said, well, you know, this is not, you know, worked that well, and those cities along the peninsula aren't getting as high ridership as San Francisco, which we sort of expected. But they've looked at moving locations to perhaps get bigger ridership. So that just happened, and we're looking into how that's going to be going.
Sandy?
As far as I'm just taking it as an assumption that helmets are not provided with the bike rental. Is that correct?
So helmets are not provided as part of the rental. You know, as you're probably aware, in California, there's no mandatory helmet law for anyone over 18. There is a number of helmet programs, which are discounted helmets to annual members. It's sort of up to the person that's using the bike to use your own helmet. The system that just launched in King County in Washington State, that state does have a mandatory helmet law, and they have a helmet sort of vending machine that they're trying out, which is part of the bike system. It allows you to rent a helmet and then sort of return it, and it gets cleaned and everything. So that's certainly something that we could look into for our system as well.
Well, I'm thinking particularly of the low-income part of the program. I mean, that's one of the things that's very noticeable to me when I'm in low-income neighborhoods, the amount of young people, or not young people, riding bikes without helmets versus in other communities. And so I think that that's part, that having some option that provides helmets for the low-income part of the program will be really important.
Yeah, we offer for all the members bike safety classes given by the bike coalitions, but that's certainly something that could be part of the low-income program, because it's a very hands-on program that we could, you know, look at something like a subsidized helmet for the low-income residents, along with more education about sort of the, you know, benefits to wearing a helmet.
Thank you. I also would think that potentially down the road, something like the Office of Traffic Safety or some, there might be additional grant funds in the future to support something like that.
I think you should just go around.
Yeah. Okay, yes, we'll just move counterclockwise.
That's how.
A real easy question, and then a comment with a question involved with it. How long are the trips in both time and miles, the average that we've had so far?
The distance is hard to measure because there's no active tracking on the bikes. But in terms of time, they're about 30 minutes, which is not surprising considering that you can check the bike out for 30 minutes without any fines. So people are going up to 28, 29 minutes in using the bike. You can. To get around that, if you're renting just a daily pass, you can ride it for 28 minutes, redock it, and then pull it back out and continue to use it. So it's kind of hard to say, because some person could dock it, that bike gets registered as being checked in, and then same person could pull the bike out and then continue riding it.
And in Redwood City, they've put up a system, and I get quite a few comments at the TA. I have not been a user of that system. But from the comments I've heard, I'll just run this by you, why we're having some problems, and then find out from you what you think. From what I understand, there's another docking station at Kaiser. There's not many additional docking stations. Kaiser has their own shuttle that goes to Caltrain. So it's almost like it's counterproductive to have it there. Now, are there more docking stations than that? Because that's the main complaint I've heard. Is that there's not enough docking stations for it in Redwood City.
Yeah, and that's a complaint throughout the entire system as well, so that's not alone. And that's something that we're looking into with our expansion plan. Those cities are continuing to be successful in sort of recognition, but they have pretty low ridership. And so Redwood City's done the most in terms of looking at how to get more riders on the system. Mm-hmm. So we'll be looking at that as part of our strategic planning efforts.
Okay, well, thank you.
I guess I was next.
Sorry. Oh, Mike. Oh,
I think I was. All right. And this is not an adversarial question. Are you a cyclist, by the way? Huh?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Then you'll understand what I say. Those bikes weigh 42 pounds.
Yes.
Okay? I've been a cyclist all my life. In fact, I commuted from Potrero Hill to SF State for 7 years to go to SF State. Okay? So I know a little bit about cycling. All right, and I realize this is a European design. My suggestion would be two things. First of all, whenever the contract comes up again, to get a bike that not only weighs less. I mean, my mountain bike weighs 31 pounds, and that's a lightweight mountain bike. My old Raleigh Grand Prix, which I bought in 1972, weighs 33 pounds, 9 pounds less than this thing. Now it's built like a tank. I understand that, but if you're in Denmark and it's flat ground, it's great. But you go up any hill with that thing, and 42 pounds is a lot of weight to drag. So I'm wondering if at some point my suggestion, I think the program is great. I have no criticism of the program at all, other than the fact that the bike weighs 42 pounds. because some of us are not in that shape. I mean, it's tough if you're not, it's a great idea, and if you're not in shape, to go up any small hill, you're pushing that bike up the hill. So I'd like to see whenever the contract comes up, or if it does come up, or if you can see about getting competitive bids about a bike that weighs less, and that has better gearing, especially for San Francisco. It's not a problem in Mountain View or any other, or in San Jose or any other place that's being used, except for San Francisco.
Yeah, well, San Francisco actually spec'd additional gears, so 7 instead of 3, which they normally come with for the hills. There's some exciting sort of technology that's coming on the horizon, including an e-assist bike share system. We don't know that much about it, but certainly has some possibilities for here, and we're going to hopefully they'll submit bids for our program, which will help to address the weight and sort of, you know, ease of use issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. An excellent report, by the way.
Thanks.
Great. We'll go to Carlos next, and then Vita.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. It sounded like in the report. I know right now this is a pilot phase, and it sounds like, you know, we're looking at funds. But I'm curious. Maybe it's a three-part question. That when do we expect this to be self-sustaining? And then my second part of this question is, are there examples in the U.S., first of all, of other self-sustaining bike share programs, and then, of course, around the world, which I'm assuming the Paris one is. But that was one question. And then the other one, on the last slide that you had before the question slide, you show the kind of the expansion. And the question there for me is the kind of a what is your location quotient for figuring out, you know, I'm trying to figure out is it activity centers, is it retail districts, is it being next to a BART station, and so I just wanted to hear a little bit more about that.
Yes, I'll take your last question about where we're putting them. So it's a combination of all that you've said, and there's a key there which is easier probably to read in your packet than on the slide, but the activity centers are. You know, job centers, retail centers, distance to transit, all the sort of urban variables, at least for the East Bay that we've looked at where to put them. So very similar to any transit system that you'd put in. Those are the kind of variables, and I can certainly go into that more. There's a pretty detailed selection process on how that was made. And then in terms of self-sufficiency, so... you know, around the world, they, especially the big systems, which are massive in comparison. So, you know, the Chinese cities have 100,000 bikes. You know, the Paris system, while big, seems small in comparison, and we're literally a drop in the bucket compared to that. Those systems, at least in Europe and Asia, are just sort of seen as, you know, transit. So they're subsidized, as far as I know. New York reports, because they had Citibank, which was a $40 million sponsorship, and they're expected to double that investment, Citibank is, and to double the system size. They say that they have really had no public investment, which doesn't really count the staff time put in by the city to make all that happen. So, you know, there's still some public money on the system. And in Washington, D.C., which includes Arlington and surrounding areas, they report nearly 90% fare box recovery for their system, which covers nearly all of their operations and maintenance, doesn't cover capital. And they rolled out a new advertising campaign for the stations themselves, similar to our bus shelters. And so with that, they expect to be very close to 100%. There was a lot in there. Was that okay?
Thank you. So Vita and then Alan?
You know, Marin County has a lot of great locations for bike riding. Have you considered expanding into the North Bay, Sonoma County, Napa County? Are we phase three?
Yeah, so Marin County has done their own feasibility study on where to put the bikes, and we're certainly looking at that with them. And then the North Counties, I mean, the difficulty is you want to put a system down that gets ridden and gets a lot of ridership, which is more, you know, in a city like San Francisco. So we're, you know, the North Counties with sort of less dense areas, similar to the peninsula, we're looking at, you know, some of the lessons learned on the peninsula and how they could be applied to the less urban areas and see how that might work.
Mm-hmm. I've got a couple more quick clarification questions. Can you tell me how much it costs to rent a bike for the day or for a half hour?
So the the annual pass is, which is you can use it essentially unlimited. It's $88, and then a 24-hour pass is $9, mm-hmm. and then a week pass is 3-day pass. Three-day pass for $9. Yeah.
For $9. This is very interesting. Is there any possibility of taking a bike from one city to the next and dropping it off in Redwood City if someone were inclined?
Well, the whole idea is that it takes the bikes out of the transit system because, you know, as was mentioned earlier, you don't want to, carry a 45-pound bike upstairs or even into a Caltrain vehicle. So the idea is to remove the bikes from the system. All the transit operators have struggled to allow people with bikes on their, you know, either on Caltrain or on BART. So the idea is that you don't have to bring your bike on board because you can ride a bike to your transit station, get off, and take another bike when you're at your location to get there. So it's not really designed for that. That's more like bike rental. So this is really designed for that first last mile solution.
Mm-hmm. And the last question is, with the bikes weighing so much, I notice your demographics are mostly men, and I wonder if that's problematic for having more women riding their bikes and also child carriers. Is that a possibility in the future?
The weight is probably certainly an issue, because they're built to stay out in mid-market 24/7, so they're very, very theft-proof, very durable. We haven't heard so much the weight in terms of, like, picking them up, but certainly riding up hills could be an issue, and maybe some of the new technologies will help to alleviate that. Bringing children, it's the bikes, under the California Vehicle Code, it says that you can't have a passenger unless the bike is designed for two, and then there's, you're only supposed to use it if you're over 18, so I don't think that would really work in California. Paris has a kid bike rental, which is very interesting. You could go to the park and then check out a bike for kids, which is very interesting. It'd be hard to carry a child on board.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your patience. I pardon my error, Jerry first and then Alan, please. Thank you.
Actually, I have several questions. First of all, I just wanted to reiterate, I'm in San Francisco. I'm not a bike rider, but it was kind of shocking to me to hear about the weight of those bikes. I ride a motorcycle, and that's 400 pounds, but even 42 pounds for a bicycle seems particularly difficult in the city, and anything that can be done to alleviate that would be really, really helpful in the next go-around. A couple of questions. One is liability issues. What happens if someone is injured on one of these bikes?
That's a good question. Actually, I'm going to defer that to the current operator, Patrick Wenzinger from the Air District, since they actually run the program right now.
First of all our members, they sign a liability waiver when they join our system to cover some of those issues, and then our contractor also carries liability insurance that covers the Air District and all the local partner agencies too. So if there was a claim against the system, they would have to first take a look at the liability waiver that they signed, and then our insurance through our contractor would cover that. We haven't had any incidences yet of claims against our system.
Okay. Thanks. I was just wondering whether you've had any kind of a study about whether what the ridership is between, say, tourists and residents. And because of that, has there been a conflict with some private bike rental companies who rent primarily to tourists?
That's an excellent question. So the pricing is structured in such a way as to not compete with the bike rental operators in and this is really a San Francisco specific issue, and actually we have the Air District has been meeting with the bike share or bike rental operators, and we actually have a meeting in the next week with all the current bike rental operators and trying to see how the system can work together. And I I think they, I would say they're generally supportive. They don't, you know, the current systems work very hard to not compete against the two and sort of seen as complementary. So if you want to take a bike, ride it over the Golden Gate Bridge, your best bet is to get a bike rental. If you want to ride, you know, up market, just a you know, several blocks, the bike share is the best way to go. So they can sort of exist in the same world, and their district has done a lot to address that.
Okay. And finally, in the end, who is actually responsible for the location of the docking stations? Is it MTC in the planning unit, or is it the private contractor?
Well, it's ultimately up to the local agency because it's going on their right of way. So they will be issuing the permit for wherever it's going, and you know, and yeah, if there's parking removal, and there's, you know, San Francisco's done a lot, and we've learned a lot, particularly with putting on sidewalks with accessibility and everything else. So yeah, it's up to the local agency.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So we'll go to Alan and then Mark.
You answered one of the questions. The local agency is responsible for locations, and I wanted to know what is the outreach that developers, because I haven't heard from anyone, and I'm building a substantial new project in San Mateo. So,
yeah, so that's all, you know, that's all part of the outreach is done, will be done by the city, and it's all part of the sort of planning and permitting process. Since we don't have anyone under a contract in terms of the expansion, you know, it's coming, but it's going to have to get done pretty quickly.
Are you scientifically building the metrics for the system in looking at the analysis of the usage, the profitability, the locations, to figure out where the best locations will be in the future, just as a retailer would?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have data from the system now, a year's worth of data, and then we also have a consultant helping us to look at expected revenue, trips per bike per day is the metric that we use, you know, geographic areas where it could go in terms of to maximize the ridership, but also balancing that with reaching, you know, low-income populations as well.
One question that enters my mind is, let's say you get to a location and you're going to drop a bike off there and there aren't any slots available. What happens?
Well, that's happened not as much in our system, but particularly in the big systems. When that occurs, the person's instructed to go to the next station, so hopefully you'll have a density you know, sufficient enough to support that. If not, then you start getting into the, you know, over the 30 minutes where you'd incur a fine. A lot of that is resolved since our system's fairly new. If you talk to the customer service support, and they typically, you know, if that situation is explained, can waive those fees.
Thank you.
Mark, go ahead. And then Mike, and then Jim.
Okay, I just want to go on record and say that I'm not a cyclist. I'm a runner. So I'm definitely encouraged with the emissions footprint that you guys are decreasing, and that's very encouraging for bike usage. But I know this is formulated in a business structure. Are you guys looking at it from personal bike usage? Are you encouraging that? Because prior to this program, there's a bunch of bike racks, lockers at some of these stations, and they seem to be disappearing. I just want to know, is any money from the program eventually going back into encouraging personal bike usage to these locations?
Well, the revenue from this program is going to expect it to go right back into the program, but you know, one of the things that's necessary for the system is that you need the infrastructure to ride the bikes on. You just can't put the stations down without a place to go. So, and that infrastructure benefits everyone. So MTC is going to continue our work on our bike programs, and the Air District as well has a grant program which funds bike lockers and racks. And so that will all be part of, you know, the sort of entire bike solution for everyone. And, you know, that while people do use these bikes, a lot of them have personal bikes as well. So survey results, you know, some are replacing that with their personal bike trip, but many of the people use it continue to have their own personal bike and then the bike share bike.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, real quick question. Not question. SMART will be done in 2016, so you have 2 years to figure out whether you want to go into Marin or not and expand, and I would say it's probably an excellent market because at least the four stations, the four biggest stations, Santa Fe, Novato, Petaluma, Santa Rosa, similar to Caltrains on the peninsula, I think it would be a great place to start in the North Bay, so you should consider that. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim and then Randy.
All right. This sounds like a great program. Now, I understand you have to have docking stations, and I think I heard you say something like around 4th and Townsend and then somewhere along the Embarcadero. Do you have docking stations throughout the city? In other words, if someone wanted to go, let's say, from 3rd and Mission, where I'm at, all the way down to North Beach or maybe even out to the Sunset, would they be able to do that?
You couldn't go to the Sunset and North Beach, but you could go everywhere else that you've described. So that's part of the pilot, is that there's a small but dense deployment of stations, and San Francisco is going to be looking to expand that, not only to add density to the system they have now, but to expand it into different areas where there's no bike share now.
Do you envision it, once you expand, that it would cover most or all of the city?
That is the plan that San Francisco has for their city, yes.
Okay. Now, tell me, in terms of users, I mean, you have competition, let's say, you know, with certain rental companies. What would be your typical users of this program?
Well, the typical user would be someone that is using it just to get around, either for work or for leisure, and coupling that with a transit trip. So that's the way it's sort of being used in the city right now. They're located near transit specifically for that reason. So it's designed to be that first last mile solution.
Yeah, that would make sense. In other words, you know, people get off the muni buses or trains, and then there would be docking stations at certain points, right?
Exactly, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Randy.
Thank you. First, I have a comment, and that's you're looking at a regional-wide program through the eyes of San Francisco, and I think you're missing a lot here. And I'll piggyback on some of the comments that Vita made. I'm seeing in San Jose on my trail, which runs, it's a creek trail that runs all the way through downtown, I'm seeing a lot of visitors using these bikes. So I'd like to know if you have any demographics, and I know that when my daughter was in Paris, she used their rental. She didn't do, a company bike rental. So do we have an idea in other areas the difference between residents and visitor usage?
Yes, we do. We have that for our own system as well as other areas. Basically, the system makes money off the what we call casual users, which are just buying, you know, 24-hour or 3-day pass. So you want a lot of those. And you also want to have it available for people that purchase an annual pass. But, the Air District has done a lot of work to look at where that revenue is coming in from the different types of people for non-members versus casual members.
Well, then that's okay. Then that's kind of making the point for me in the helmet issue, because the people that I've talked to, and it's really weird because I've had this conversation like 3 times in the last couple of weeks with people on the trails. It's like, oh, do you live here or are you visiting? And their comments were, we really would have loved to have had a helmet. And this was after a guy took a header off a hill coming down a slope, and somebody walking out in front of him and having to dump the bike in order. So there was a situation where, we could have had a very serious injury. So I'm hoping that you kind of push the helmet issue especially when you can track the areas where it's visitors versus tourists or transient ones. The other request that we had was for something that families could actually use. because they're out on the trail. They bring their families here for extended stays, and it's not unusual for us to have people here for 6 weeks coming into jobs and going out. I'd also like to see if you can add maybe a Clipper format for payment, for especially for the low income, if you already have a Clipper card that works. What was the other thing that I had? And then when you're talking about offsetting VMT, I want you to make sure that you're building in, because I have a friend who uses it in San Francisco all the time, and she's an avid cyclist, but she's getting really frustrated with either waiting for bikes to be delivered or waiting for a place to dock the bike. So there's an offset to the VMT that you, I mean, because you're using a car to, or a truck to go pick up the bikes and take them. So when you're doing those calculations, I'd like to make sure that those are mixed in. That's part of the problem, the analysis when you do that. But I just really have to come back to the idea that as you say, you make your money off the people who aren't residents. The money-making portion of that is people who are transient users who are only there for a while. And San Jose doesn't have a lot of bike rental locations. But we have a lot of people who come into town who would like to use these. And I'm guessing that Marin, it's the same way, that you have an opportunity there. So it would, when you bring this back to us again, if you have a list of the bike rental groups that you're working with, because I have zero idea. If you're talking about 20, if you're talking about 500 companies, if you're talking about 3. So that would be interesting, because I realize we're using this in lieu of transit, but without the safety features, without the helmets, the people who are here visiting are going to not ride a bike when they don't feel safe, and they're going to get into a vehicle to go visit something. You know, you're not going to stay in your hotel the whole time you're here. So it's something that I want you guys to be really aware of.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Randy. So we'll hear from Carlos.
Thanks again. I don't want to beat this drum too much. In hearing the most recent comments, you know, I just want to emphasize that really it sounds to me that this, it's almost like potentially a two-system approach, you know, that I think it's very valid, and I think in the examples of Paris and other big cities that you don't want to be in competition with the bike rental places. So you really need to, and I think you have a niche there that really fits that kind of like, I need to get down the street, you know, and you know, it's just in the next hour, and then just drop it off, you know, just drop it off and don't worry about it, and hope that you have one to get back, you know, and that's like almost like a, you know, a work time issue kind of thing. But it could be also, you know, out of work in the weekends too. And then there is this kind of the Bay Area being a destination for a lot of folks, and thinking in that realm too. That's why I don't want to beat it, because I think it's been said enough. But my question before I forget it is, it's a clarifying question, because I also hear some of the comments being made, and if you can help me understand this, does this system, I have a friend who works in Hennepin County in Minnesota and Minneapolis, and she's in charge of their system over there. And she told me about how portable these docking stations are, that basically they can put them on the back of a truck and move them and drop them somewhere else. And we were talking about like doing the market studies. And I think that from what I understand, at least their system, I wanted to ask you if our system is like that, that it's that flexible that we can almost road test another location pretty quickly if the jurisdiction agrees to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what Redwood City's done. They've looked at this existing station locations and said, well, is this really working out? And they've moved the stations based on that, and the ability to sort of move them, which is, you know, since they're off the grid, there's no power, there's no communications, is kind of a unique feature of the system, and certainly that's that's been done with our system and other systems, and we expect that we'll continue to refine the exact locations in the future.
Okay, Will, and then Randy, and then Sandy.
Of your 39,000, you know, members on it, how many of them are low income?
Well, that's a combination of the casual users, which can just check out a bike with a credit card, and so we don't have that much information from those users, but we do have information on some information on the annual users,
right.
Which
just the annual members.
Yeah, so that is you know, I had that slide of kind of who's using it, so very few.
Very few.
Yes. Yeah.
And then do you understand why you have very few?
Yeah, and that's why we have a low-income pilot, which we're expecting to roll out in next year.
You said you're familiar with the large bicycle population in China, and they use it for commuting to work and for shopping and for daycare. So they have different bikes for different purposes all in the docking stations on it. Now, that's what attracts those people that rely on it in the city or in the urban areas. So I was just wondering, if you have such a low participation from the low-income population, what are you doing to find out how to improve it for them?
Yeah, so that's part of the low-income pilot program that I mentioned that we're debuting in San Francisco, working with the Air District and MTA. So that's working with a community-based organization to reach people that otherwise wouldn't be from the traditional marketing for bike share.
Because it seems like, you know, the outreach for the low-income people, they look at it and saying there's very little benefit because when I go shopping, there's no place for me to park the bike and make a stand so I can go in there and purchase something. So I think that sometimes when you say, you know, you have a low-income population, and basically, who is it and what is it? It's basically low-income working people, and that's it. Right. Hopefully you expand it a little bit more in the future.
Randy?
Thank you. Carlos reminded me that when you're looking at new locations and you're looking at the portability of docking stations, to be looking at event-specific things, simply because we have a new 49ers stadium that can't handle the vehicles, and it can handle, because they've closed off the trails, it can handle bikes. So, and with the new soccer stadium opening in South Bay, but there's so many events that go on that you could theoretically get people potentially out of vehicles and get them connected a little easier and get them off the streets and out of our driveways. So thank you.
Sandy, and then Mark, and then Vita.
Oh, I thought that Randy's point about trying to connect the pay to the Clipper card, I think, is a great idea, and I think it might really help enhance people who are already transit users starting to think of this as something that would enhance their transit use. So I just wanted to say that. And then the comment around your response to Will's question regarding how you're getting input from communities, from low-income communities, I think that, I have nothing against community-based organizations. Community-based organizations do great work, but sometimes I think they can have limited reach. They don't, not all low-income people have relationships with a community-based organization. So I think there might be other ways of finding out the needs of low-income people that may not have anything to do with community-based organizations.
Thank you. Mark, and then Vita?
I just wanted to... clarity on the usage of the bike. Is it intended for recreation and leisure, or is it intended for business trips?
No, it's really intended for, the sort of your day-to-day activities that are pretty short, so less than 30 minutes. So, in about 30 minutes, if you think about where you go and what type of trip that is, that's really sort of getting to, a work-type trip, work while you're on the job getting somewhere, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's not designed to go long distances, as you've heard the comments from the bike weighing nearly 45 pounds. So, yeah.
Vita?
Thanks, Mark.
thanks for coming down here. I've got to say, this is a very exciting program, and we have so many questions because there's so much opportunity here. You know, you reach some people at so many different levels, from an exercise standpoint to a, you know, practicality standpoint of going to the market, picking up your groceries, to sightseeing, and there are a lot of opportunities here. And, you know, I welcome looking at it from different aspects. So I'm interested in more of the demographics. I see that you have 700 bikes, and I'm wondering how many locations you have for your docking stations. And I really like the opportunity of us looking outside the box, especially if these docking stations are portable, to take them to other areas and have the bikes being mobile to help offset our climate change that's happening from, you know, pollution with our air to settling traffic jams. I mean, it's just lends itself to so much potential, and it's very exciting. And I think that's why we have so many questions and so many opportunities for expansion here. And I'm just wondering how many docking stations we currently have and how many you're projecting for the future.
We have about 70 right now that's spread out through those five cities. We're still working on the exact sort of estimate on where we're going to expand in the East Bay. Part of that is we don't have any bids from anyone right now, so it's hard to know the pricing. But we hope to have a pretty East Bay system of comparable size.
Mm-hmm. Now that you've gone through your first year, and just one quick follow-up, are you reevaluating what your initial concept was? And with the public input and the input from our advisory committee, will there be some opportunities for tweaking the system and rethinking the way that the bike system is set up?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been a lot of changes to technology and how the system's been run, which will allow for different pricing structures and different ways how we've done things. And we're also, as I mentioned, working on the strategic plan, which is lessons learned from the pilot program and so how we can apply that to expansion. And we can certainly come back to you guys with updates on that, which will be in the next few months.
Thanks. Chris?
Thanks, and thanks for a good report. It looks like of your 700 bikes, or the average usage is more than 500 trips in a year. That sounds like a lot, but these are short trips, and it seems like there could be many more than those 500 average. What do you think the demand is, and as you expand, where is that demand going to come from if you're not getting all the use that you can up from these 700?
Well, the biggest complaint of the system right now is that there aren't enough stations and bikes. So with the expansion and adding more capacity to the system, I think that'll help to alleviate that. You know, the metric that is sort of used to gauge, you know, usage on the system is the number of trips per bike per day. So in San Francisco, it's about, you know, 1.5 or so, because you want over one, but you don't want it too high, because then if it's too high, you can't find bikes. So there's a balance between those sort of metrics. And, you know, San Francisco thinks that it could grow a lot and get a lot more usage. The East Bay, we expect a lot. Because there's, you know, the downtown Oakland, and then they'll be tied in with UC Berkeley and the city of Berkeley. So we don't really know what our sort of, you know, upper limit on which we can get the most ridership, get the most recovery while having the most bikes available. But we're continuing to monitor the system daily, and we've done quite a bit of survey work of people and we'll be doing it on an ongoing basis, and we can report back to you guys on that.
Just to make sure I understand, less than two trips a day is considered good use of the bikes?
Yeah, I mean, you want the bike used, you know, more than once, mm-hmm, per day at a location, generally. So, and then if you get into higher than that, then there's problems with the bikes being available. And hence, yeah, you know, getting more vehicles out there to rebalance the bikes. So, Yeah, I mean it's pretty new. The entire bike share industry in all the cities is like 5 years old. So so everyone's learning at the same time.
Okay, thanks.
I'll go ahead and move us along. I just had a couple questions of my own. And obviously, yes, there is a lot of interest in this. So I think once there's potentially a draft of the strategic plan, if we could come back and get an update or whatever is an appropriate point. In terms of the rebalancing and backing out those VMT from any gains, are there model? How has that been done and made explicit in some of the evaluations from cities that are a little older than our system?
Well, for us, that's a very important consideration since the program is being run by the Air District, and that's one of their missions is to reduce vehicle emissions. So there's some opportunities in terms of the fuels that the vehicles use. Some have used there's been combinations of everything from pedal like bikes with trailers to tow the bikes, so that's essentially a zero emissions trip. It seems I don't think that's worked in a widespread way to all sorts of different vehicle types. So electric vehicles, vehicles with biodiesel, that sort of thing. And so there's been ways to sort of optimize that with the vehicles, as well as I think what's going to be happening in the future is there'll be opportunities to use pricing to sort of rebalance the system, but it's very new and hasn't been done yet. So that'll hopefully reduce the amount that people have to be cruisingly driving around rebalancing the bikes.
So almost like a congestion pricing applied to the bike share itself.
Yeah.
Okay. And then in terms of the flexibility of bike types, I know you mentioned in your memo about the supplier going offline and then coming back online. Are there opportunities to have more flexible bike types, like some of the cargo bikes and situations that Will mentioned, or would that require changes to the California Vehicle Code?
Well, the cargo bikes specifically, the entire bike share system relies on uniformity. So if you want a cargo bike, we would have to be able to track where that cargo bike is, and you'd have to get yourself to that cargo bike and check it out. And so it then becomes a pretty different system versus you can go to any station, check out the same bike, take your trip, and put it in any other station. So some have experimented with that, but it's been difficult because you need a dispatch person to sort of say, for any different types, it can hold more than one person, more cargo. So I don't know if that the changes to technology will allow that anytime soon, but there are perhaps some opportunities for lower cost bikes for the system, which we'll see who comes in to bid, but there's a lot more technology than there was just 3 years ago.
And then lastly, quickly, for the cities that aren't currently projected for expansion but have interests, like El Cerrito, Daly City come to mind, will the strategic plan be putting in place, like, what could you be doing now to lay the groundwork for this? Like, what could future phase three cities be doing?
Exactly, yeah, as well as cost, which is an important consideration. So operations and maintenance costs, what does the city need to do in terms of planning and budgeting and all that? So yeah, it'll help outline that.
Fielding a whole lot of questions. Thank you. Oh, Jerry, and the last one, and then we'll move on.
Thank you. Question, what's the cost of that individual bike?
Well, the
present?
Yeah, so the bike, which is includes, well, the if you're asking for the replacement cost, which is what you put on your credit card, and mm-hmm. then if you get charged, it's about $1,100. So, again, a big, heavy piece of, think of it more as like a piece of a bike that's more like built to street furniture spec than like an actual bike. So there's, pretty complicated things on there that keep it from being stolen.
Yeah, you won't put it in your backpack. It won't fit, right? But I guess an issue for me is that at $1,100, do we put these people in their own bike? If it's only going to be used for two trips in a day, as someone mentioned, to and from, 30 minutes, I would like to see it used more, I hope, than that. Other than that, someone could carry their own bike. You could almost give them a folding bike for half that and get them off the road.
Right.
But get them and get that bike where we don't have to have parking stations.
Right.
So...
Yeah, I mean, it gets comparable in terms of if you think about the price of a locker, you know, electric locker, it's close to that. So for BART to put in an e-locker versus a bike, I mean, you're getting close. Both try to get you to not bring your bike on the mm-hmm. system and have it available. So,
yes.
Yeah, it's there. There are solutions out there, but they're not inexpensive. I mean, compared to transit, though, it's a deal. So,
thank you, Sean. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you, Kevin, Patrick, and Sean. And I think with that, we'll go ahead and move on to agenda item 7, but look forward to hearing back. Thank you. So now we'll hear about the Bay Area Regional Prosperity Plan project from Vikrant Sood.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Vikrant Sood, and I'm the program manager for this project, what we're calling the Regional Prosperity Plan Project. We haven't come to this group as often as we would have liked. I believe this is probably the second update that we are providing to you, the first one being probably almost 2 years ago. So we are happy to provide this update for a couple of reasons. One, there is quite a bit happening with the project. And two, I think it would be really useful to get some feedback from this group about how some of the work that is happening relates to the concerns that you may have. So just as a broad overview, Kathleen, I just want to make sure I have about 15 minutes, right, total, because we're running a little late. So I'll try and go through my presentation a little faster, and I'll skip some slides, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions offline as well.
That sounds wonderful, because I think there will be some questions.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So one of the things you might be wondering is, why is MTC, the Regional Transportation Planning Agency, working on a project that has to do with economic development, housing, and its integration with transportation, but transportation being one of the many components? And just to give you an update on what was happening at the federal level. I think the three federal agencies, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Transportation Department at the federal level, they set up a program which is called the Sustainable Communities Initiative, and that was really to promote regional planning for an integrated system of economic development, land use planning, transportation, transit, and services. And given that most regions don't have an agency set up to implement a project like that, MTC and ABAG step forward to administer the project, but it is being implemented by a very broad consortium which includes stakeholders from multiple sectors, including our local jurisdictions, community-based organizations, and economic development agencies. So this was a $5 million grant program. We have about 3 years to implement the overall work plan. We started in March of 2012, so we are nearing the end. But it was also structured in a way where we couldn't have implemented a lot of projects before doing a little bit of planning. So this is why we are still implementing many of our pilot projects. We hope to finish them by March 2015. The project is being led by MTC and ABAG, like I mentioned, and partly because we see this as an implementation component to Plan Bay Area. Many of the critical issues that were identified by Plan Bay Area when we were planning for the last regional transportation plan, many of the issues that were identified were not directly be able to addressed at that point. So we at that point had decided that something like the Regional Prosperity Plan could then address these projects before the next update. So issues like expanding the economic mobility and opportunities for all workers, but especially the low and moderate income workers, making sure that there is affordable housing available close to transit, especially if you're going to be making a lot of investments in those smart growth areas, and then addressing the stabilization of communities in neighborhoods where there may be a risk of displacement. We know that these issues are influenced by a lot of national, state, and regional trends, many of which may not be in our control. Things like the structure of the economy, which has been changing over the last 50 years, and especially has changed over the last 20 years, where instead of producing a vast majority of moderate income or middle income jobs, we are now producing primarily high income jobs and very low income jobs. So, for example, in terms of what we are producing in the Bay Area between 2010 and 2020, it's only about 30,000 job openings in the middle wage category. And we have a population of more than a million people, which is a third of our workforce, which is earning less than $18 an hour. And the primary economic opportunity historically for a lot of these workers was the availability of middle wage jobs, so they could move up in their in their career pathways. At the same time, the real wages for the workers at the bottom of the wage scale have stagnated. This is happening over the last 50 years. I think we're all quite familiar with some of this data. But housing costs, as we know, especially in the Bay Area, have not. Even nationally, the median income, while remaining flat, the housing prices, both in terms of ownership as well as rental, has increased substantially, even though there have been some significant drops during times of recession. While the low-income population, their ability to have a disposable income has shrunk, there is also a significant shrinkage in the availability of resources for public agencies. And that constrains the ability of our local jurisdictions to provide services and amenities like affordable housing. And a study that was done by ABAG as part of this project estimated that we have a funding gap of about $3.2 billion per year, every year, for the next 25 years if we have to fund or meet the needs of our low and moderate income workers for affordable housing. There is also a spatial component to the jobs housing mismatch, and I think this is something probably most of your organizations or you individually might be experiencing as well. But if you look at the map, it shows the proportion of low-wage jobs and the proportion is to the number of housing units that are affordable to those low-income workers. So if you look at the colors, the red color really denotes where there are five low-wage jobs for every housing unit available that is affordable to that low-wage worker. On the other hand, the green areas denote places where there is more or less a balance between those two factors, but it also kind of points to the fact that these are the areas that need some economic development where the middle wage jobs need to be grown. We also have a national trend where there is increasing suburbanization of poverty. That's the term that's being used. So, for example, about 5% of poverty in the urban areas increased by about 5% over the last 10 years, whereas in the suburban areas, it increased by 25%. So we are seeing a lot of people either being displaced or moving to the suburbs where there is fewer opportunities for transit, fewer opportunities for economic mobility, fewer social services, and then you're seeing these people and households get poorer in place. There is also a big challenge with the entire project. We have to acknowledge the fact that this is for the first time we have a very broad-based consensus-based collaborative consortium-led process, which has its own challenges. And we are working in a context where we don't really know how some of the recommendations that we are developing are going to be implemented. So that has its own challenges. So just to recognize that as well. But we are moving forward on a consensus basis. We have three working groups that are charged with implementing specific pieces of the work plan. It's being all the three working groups then report or provide their recommendations to what's called a joint projects team, which is where the co-chairs of the three working group, as well as the regional agency staff, kind of work on coordinating all the efforts. And then we have a steering committee that makes the decisions and includes elected officials from MTC and ABAG, in addition to the co-chairs. We have three work elements, and I'll just very quickly go through these, and I won't go through the examples, which have a lot of the richness and the details about what we are eventually going to be implementing. But we have recently completed a technical analysis, which was supported with a very extensive outreach effort as well to develop what's called the economic prosperity strategy. It includes three goals and about 10 strategies, and all of them are focused on maximizing and promoting the economic opportunities for low and moderate income workers. We also funded about 11 pilot projects that would be testing some of these strategies that were identified in this program. And I'll just quickly just skip over some of the examples of the projects. We're also funding about 22 pilot projects with more than $1 million to develop our toolkit and resources for the production of affordable housing, preservation of affordable housing, and then addressing displacement of low-income populations. So we're looking at some new funding opportunities at the local level, especially, you know, given the fact that the redevelopment agencies are no longer able to provide a lot of the resources that were originally going into producing these affordable housing units. So there are some interesting funding strategies that are being explored. We're also looking at just preserving what we already have, because there is there's a pretty significant housing stock that is at risk of converting to market rate, even though they were built with public subsidies. We're also looking at some tools so we can better understand the displacement risks in the region. And then we had an entire program that was funding the capacity building of our community-based organizations and residents to engage with this project and implement the work element. The graphic just shows you the distribution of our grant funds. And, you know, we were hoping that there would be a wider kind of spread, but we you know, there are some challenges that we identified in terms of the capacity of the community-based organizations in some of the outlying areas to be even able to apply for some of the funding, which we've noted. So in terms of next steps, what we're hoping to do is complete these pilot projects. We do want to document the best practices and lessons. We will be developing an action plan, which will recommend how to continue some of this work forward. And then we hope to provide these regular updates to MTC and ABAC committees, especially given the fact that this is, you know, like I mentioned, this is not an MTC ABAC project. We are administering and facilitating this process, so the recommendations that are developed are not going to come straight in front of the two agencies for adoption. We will be, you know, doing that as a follow-up after the project is finished. So with that and a very quick update, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very quick. Thank you. Do we have any initial questions? Thank you. So one question that I did have was really kind of trying to tie in the work, the very local work that some of the CBOs are doing in these pilots, because I know that the implementation really will be local. How explicit has it been with staff and consultants making the connection to Plan Bay Area, making the connection to sort of some of the regional goals for why this was even done in the first place? Or has it really been focused on their core work that they typically do?
No, I think you're right. It was, you know, the issues that were identified as part of Plan Bay Area implementation, those were the basic parameters for even, you know, setting up the entire grant program. So it was part of the requirement of all the sub-grants to be able to develop new tools or come up with new mechanisms to address the issues that are relevant to Plan Bay Area implementation. So there is a direct tie there. The part that isn't entirely clear is there are things that MTC and ABAG can do to implement Plan Bay Area, and then there are a lot of things that are beyond the jurisdiction of the two regional agencies, and then other local and regional actors need to step up to implement those pieces. So there is that component as well, but most of it is directed towards implementing the recommendations of Plan Bay Area.
And then as far as you were here during the previous agenda item, and Sandy made the comment that many low-income folks or low- and moderate-income folks aren't necessarily tapped into some of the supports that are available in their communities. So I was wondering how, since you did move through the project examples quickly and needed to, how were you working or connecting with workers who may not, you know, may not be tapped into those, may not ever tap into those, but could still would benefit from increased access to all of these things?
Right. I think that was a big goal for the project. So, for example, for the economic prosperity strategy, we did, you know, we directly engaged low-income workers. So it wasn't enough just to invite the community-based organizations or the labor groups that represent these workers. We had some sessions directly with the workers. So, you know, that doesn't mean that we engaged the vast majority of workers and got their feedback, but, you know, there were different ways of getting to the same, you know, getting the same perspective at least. I don't think we've been completely successful because there is that lack of capacity. Like Sandy was saying, I mean, it's hard for a regional agency or for, you know, processes like this, which are more regional in nature, for us to, A, first build capacity at the local level and then engage those organizations and resident leaders. We've tried to build some of that capacity, but I think it's an ongoing work, piece of work anyway. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does, but I like that, you know, you're highlighting the need to build that capacity, because I think sometimes if you didn't get a lot of applicants from an area, that's telling in and of itself and would be worthy of some future resources, I would think, if possible.
And those are the kind of things that we'll document as lessons learned in the final report as well.
Okay. All right. Vita?
I see in slide number 22 a wonderful graph that... my glasses on. In slide 22, we see a graphic showing fund distribution. Is this a chart that is indicative of the population as it appears in the Bay Area? I see most of the funding was going towards the East Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give me some information about the demographic split for the funding?
We haven't tabulated all of that information yet, but it does not, I mean, the proportions are not representative of the populations in those areas. So, okay. I mean, if you look at East Bay, Alameda and Contra Costa County is not 50% of the total population in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have those detailed numbers yet, but this was at least, you know, first cut of, like, this is where the money has gone. But even though we had stated a goal that we would want to, you know, fund more projects in areas where there is higher need. So it wasn't going to be tied to population, the total population. It was going to be more tied to the need,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, in other words, the total population of, you know, the communities of concern. So we haven't done that detailed analysis yet, but we know we've missed our target.
And I appreciate you coming here and giving us a brief overview with a lot of interesting details, and I hope that you have the opportunity to come back.
Sure.
And I'd also I'm also wondering if there's opportunities for other nonprofits to plug in for additional grant funding. And I saw in one of the earlier charts that we have the availability until April of 2015, is that correct?
That's right, but we've actually given out most of our all of our grant funding at this point. So we are now wrapping up those grant projects. So
okay.
There wouldn't be any additional funding available, but I should mention, and I think it should be somewhere here in the presentation as well, that of the $5 million, we are the only project in the country where the vast majority of it, of that funding, about $3.6 million of that, went directly to the community-based organizations and local jurisdictions for projects at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
Most other regions, you know, the work was done by consultants or regional agencies, whereas we relied very heavily on our local partners to come up with innovative and creative solutions.
And I appreciate you coming in here. And just one more quick question. It's a lot of information coming fast. And if we refer to slide number 9, you mentioned the suburbanization of poverty. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned an increase of 25%. During what time frame did we see this increase of 25%?
It should be in the on the graphic itself. Let me just quickly look for it.
2000 to 2009, so the two census periods, I believe.
Thank you.
Is that what it is?
It's very small.
Yeah. Sorry. It's hard to read, but it's a 10-year period.
All right. Thank you. And Randy, I believe?
Thank you. Sorry that I had to step out, but just in kind of circling back to Vita's initial question about the disparity between the amounts distributed in the funds and going back and looking at the makeup of the steering committee membership, I think it's kind of obvious that there's a huge disparity there if you balance it out by population. So I would hope that the lessons learned would be including the idea that a steering committee should be more representative of the regional population. I just find this one quite honestly appalling.
It was a challenge just recruiting people who were representing, and we fully recognize the issue. You know, just as an example, if you look at, you know, the whole discussion around displacement, a lot of the CBOs that have capacity to engage in these discussions are in the inner core urban areas. So, you know, that's the perspective that gets represented. Whereas if you look at East Contra Costa County, where a lot of the people who were displaced have landed, there isn't, like, it's very hard to find CBOs or resident leaders who, you know, who are set up to engage with, you know, something like a regional process to bring that perspective on the table. So we definitely are going to highlight that as, you know, that is a challenge. It's an ongoing challenge. I don't think the regional agencies by themselves are going to be able to address some of that. But it is something that we would like to highlight in the final report.
Well, I'm going to push back on you a little bit on that because San Jose has a population of about 1 million people, and that's not the entire county. So that gives us a population greater than some of the counties that are represented here multiple times, which is it's just not a good balance. So you can't tell me that the displacement problems that you're seeing in Oakland or San Francisco are any different than ones in San Jose, which actually has a higher level of unaffordable housing than any other place in the region right now. So this has to change because this is not an equitable setup from the get-go. And I'm not going to quibble over what is essentially on a regional scale a small amount of money, but I am going to quibble with the process that set up a steering committee that's this off balance.
Thank you. So the other piece I was wondering about was bringing this piece together with the other elements of the overall grant and the equity work that's going on. Can you tell us a little bit about subsequent, what forthcoming steps for putting it all back together? I know it's been a lot of work.
So the projects, if you look at the slide 21, it lays out at least what the program was for the equity initiative, and it was focused on engaging the disadvantaged communities, which was your previous question, in the, you know, developing the recommendations, implementing the project. You know, I'm not entirely sure, like, what the question was, but, I mean, there is an entire program. We have funded about 14 projects. Those are being led by the CBOs. But, sorry, if you could just clarify the question.
For example, so come this spring or come the summer when their projects are done,
right,
gathering the learnings from those, encapsulating them, it's going to be, what, a report? Is there going to be a learning, a true ongoing learning and leadership institute that reconvenes every year, or?
Yeah. So a couple of things. So as part of this project, you know, we consider this as a pilot, and I think a lot of people who were engaged in this process, you know, recognize the issues that we weren't able to address, but I think they are committed to making sure that this is an ongoing process and we learn from what we're doing. And to that extent, we will be documenting in a final report the lessons learned, the best practices, you know, the gaps that we still need to fill. but we are also at that point going to be able to comment on, like, what is the institutionalization of some of this work. Right now, it's residing, it's housed at MTC because we are facilitating the process, but whom do we hand it off to? There isn't a regional agency that is, or entity that can take this forward to implementation, nor is there any sub-regional entity. So, I mean, that is part of the charge of the consortium to figure out what that mechanism is to continue the work.
Thank you. I would say, moving forward, given the pace that regional work moves and the importance of making sure people have a good skills fit for these jobs, I would really see some value in working with high schools and community college districts, mm-hmm. as we're going to have to be able to facilitate moving into vocational and technical work for some folks. And I know there were some youth-focused pilots, but I'm not sure how many, and I would just... By the time this is done and moves toward implementation, these 16-year-olds are going to be in their mid-20s. They're going to be the workers.
Right.
So it's important, I think. So Randy and then Sandy, and I see Rich and Vita.
Thank you. So kind of going back to the disparity that I'm seeing here, when you look at the leadership training and that $655,000, which, again, is like in the big picture, nothing money, what... So I'm not seeing Santa Clara County represented here, pretty much, and I'm wondering how leadership academies were established, and what the criteria for these were, and if you have something that you can send me to online,
yeah,
I'm fine with taking it that way, minutes or meeting notes or anything, but. I just think that having sat on an equity committee on this body for a number of years, that this wouldn't have passed through us very easily because it just doesn't feel balanced. It doesn't feel balanced for those of us in Santa Clara County, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of North County represented in here or the North Bay, but I may be missing it. You're there. Okay. All right, thank you.
Sandy?
Hi, Vikrant. Kind of speaking to this last issue, I think, looking at the pie chart that shows the distribution of grant funds, I think it would be helpful for when this is reported again to the commission and obviously the general public at the same time, to also have more of a breakdown of... Because I'm assuming that there were different kinds of breakdowns for the three different topic areas, right, based on where there was capacity for different types of projects. So I think it enhances understanding. And then if you looking at where it shows the amount of awards and the that gives supplementary information. But if there could be some kind of infographic that more succinctly summarizes it, I think that would be helpful. Just for general understanding of where. Which types of projects were able to find distribution in other parts of the region based on capacity. And there was another point I was going to make, and I can't remember what it was. Oh, yeah. So when you're going to come to the base, the kind of following Kathleen's question about the end product, is there going to be some kind of decision-making process for how does this get sustained? What is the future of this, or is it... And is that going to come back to the commission? Or, how is that process going to work to be able to come up with some plan so that different parts of this plan can keep moving forward?
Right. So I think the point may have been lost. So let me go over that again. So this is, again, a consortium-led process. This is not something that MTC is leading or ABAG is leading. We've set up a steering committee. We've set up the different working groups. So, for example, the Equity Collaborative is leading the Equity Initiative, which is composed of community-based organizations. It's really up to the consortium as a whole to determine what they want to see that comes next. There are different models and examples of how different regions have done that. We don't really know at this point what the consortium is going to recommend for the Bay Area. So that is, again, like it's not an MTC decision to decide, like, this is how it needs to move forward. It's really these, a very broad range of stakeholders who are working together to figure some of that out. We'll go through some of our review processes. You know, there'll be open workshops. We want to have, a two-day event where we share some of this information in March with our broader consortium partners and see what their feedback would be. But I think all of that is still to be determined and kind of really relies on, what the steering committee and the consortium partners decide.
Yeah, a good comment that Kathleen made was working with the community colleges, but there's an organization in each county that is sort of centered with the community colleges in partnership, Health and Human Services. It's called the Workforce Investment Boards, and I'm sure, even though it's not apparent here, that this is designed to work with them. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, that's okay. Right. If you look at the first goal of the economic prosperity strategy, there are three goals overall. The first goal is entirely around workforce development and how to connect people to jobs eventually.
Yeah, you don't have to reinvent the wheel on it. There's already organizations doing it. You just plug in with them.
Yeah.
And, Randy, I see three organizations, I'll tell you offline, that I know are San Jose-based that are in this.
Vita, thank you. Thank you, Rich.
And thank you very much for explaining the consortium-led process. And I'm sure at the beginning of the process, you had a long-term vision of what happens after the consortium has completed its project. So I'm wondering what the mechanism to move this forward was decided when the project was started. So, I mean, you must have a project or a goal at the beginning of your project about how to move it forward. So the long-term strategic plan to move it forward, what was that mechanism you had in mind at the beginning?
So I came into the project 6 months after the project was started, but I know there was an entire six-month process just to write the grant application to HUD. Mm-hmm. Over the first 6 months when it was the application was put in place, then over another 6 months when there was a review process with HUD and the final work plan was developed, I don't think the consortium members had determined any of that. There wasn't really a vision of how this was going to work after this project, which is why we've kind of started that discussion now. Also because we didn't really know where this would go. This is very new territory for the region. Mm-hmm. And definitely for the regional agencies. Mm-hmm. This kind of a process hasn't been implemented or conceived of, at least in the Bay Area. And I would say before this project was implemented across the nation in any other region as well. I mean, there are some exceptions to the rule, but mm-hmm. not really. So it's very new. We didn't know where this was going to go. We have some successes now. So that's why we're now starting to think about where it might go.
And one other quick question, and I really, I'm just stunned that you didn't have a goal or a long-term objective with this, that there was nothing that kept you on the, a guide to give you a long-term goal. So maybe this is one of the key things to learn for the future is to figure out where the finish line is. And then the second question is, you mentioned that there are still gaps to fill and there is still some funding available. And I'm wondering if you could use the rest of that funding to fill those gaps specifically.
Actually, we don't have any funding left. All the projects were funded through a competitive process, so it was a call for projects process. And so the consortium laid out some goals and principles and guidelines and criteria. It was then distributed to the community-based organizations that the consortium had access to. So we went through that process. We've allocated all the resources. So we don't have anything left to give out. But I think we've started to have the conversations where we're working with our community-based organizations and foundations to see, you know, when we are talking about next steps, so there are specific actions and strategies that could be put in place. There's still a question of, like, who's going to coordinate it, but at least the strategies will be looking at how to fill those gaps, be it, you know, data points or capacity in certain community-based organizations.
Mm-hmm. No sub-grant funding available?
Anymore, yeah.
Anymore.
We've given out all the funding.
Okay. All right, thank you. My big hope for this is that it gets really explicit how this feeds back into the 2017 RTP SCS and then the subsequent one after that. I am going to move us forward if there were no other questions. Or Randy has one last comment, but Vikrant, I'll thank you now for your time and your report.
Thank you. And I think that taking lessons learned when a steering committee is formed that is representing implementation of something that we have input on and we don't have input on the anything that the steering committee does, that just is a disconnect. But each one of these projects has theoretically, as a pilot program, a next steps. I'm not quite seeing it on these, so I'm going to assume that the final analysis, a pilot project is designed to, well, if we do this on a small scale, can we expand it to a larger scale? So I'm going to, can I assume that when the final stuff is, that there's a deeper matrix that tells me all of that?
Yes.
Thank you. And you'll send it to us.
It'll
you'll send
be
it
made
to
available.
Pam and she'll send it to us.
Yes. We'd Thank be you. Happy to share it.
Thank you very much. Okay. And with that, we'll move very quickly to item 8, the staff liaison report. We have Leslie Lara here.
So you have Pam's report there before you, but I just want to make a quick announcement that's not included in her report, is that our preliminary draft for our public participation plan for the next round of our Plan Bay Area was released on Friday, November 7th for public comment, and the written comments are due to MTC's Public Information Office by January 12th. Of 2015. So if you go online to our website, it's right there on the homepage. You can review the public participation plan and give us your comments. We hope you help us get the word out to your communities about the plan availability and the comments due in January. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And so with item 9, council member reports, I would like to very quickly make one that today is Richard Burnett's birthday. So if we could all wish him a quick happy birthday. Did any other council member, Jerry?
Yes, I just wanted to send along a note of congratulations to Chris Corsi, who was elected to the city council in Santa Rosa. And
congratulations.
It's nice to have a colleague that is going to move on for positive reasons.
Oh, that's our loss, but Santa Rosa's gain. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks, Jerry. I was going to announce that. The good news, bad news announcement, and you can pick which one is the good news, but this will be my last meeting of the Policy Advisory Council.
Well, Chris, thank you for your contributions and commentary. We'll keep in touch. And then seeing no additional council member reports, is there any new business? Nope. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.